Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. As many of you go to the polls today, you'll be standing in line waiting for ballots next to your neighbors, some of whom you'll know and others who will be complete strangers.
Increasingly, we don't interact with our neighbors or even need to leave our homes. Everything from toothpaste to shoes to butternut squash can be delivered right to our doorsteps.
But that convenience may be coming at a cost to our health. Developmental psychologist and author Susan Pinker argues that face-to-face personal relationships can have a positive effect on our health, and a lack of them can be damaging to our physical well-being.
She writes about the importance of these interactions in her new book, The Village Effect: How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter.
Susan Pinker will be reading from and signing her book tonight at the Harvard Coop in Cambridge. But first, she joins us here in the studio on Radio Boston. Susan, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
And listeners, we imagine that many of you have debated this. You've thought about what are the downsides of all the time we spend online and not interacting face-to-face with other people. In particular, we want to know what you think about Susan Pinker's argument that our physical health, not just our mental health, but our physical health suffers when we live our lives in increasing digital isolation rather than, say, gathered together for a family meal or out with friends. We want to know how online social networks affect your life for better or for worse. You may think they're a positive thing entirely. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Susan Pinker, I think this idea in general that there is a big downside, a negative side to so much of life being online, that argument isn't so new. We've heard that from sort of Bowling Alone books way back, but you really hone in on the physical impact, which I think will surprise many people, that we can actually chart a decline in certain physical health in the process. So I want you to get to that eventually, but first, could you go right to your title? You talk about the village effect, and that, tell us what you mean by that.
Well, the village effect is a metaphor, really, for the kind of social contact that we need to survive and thrive as a human species. So many of us now conflate the kind of social contact that we get from the screen with the contact that we get from our friends and neighbors and family and people that we might meet at work and as we move through our day. But the evidence that's emerging is telling us that it's not at all the same, and it doesn't have the same impact on our health at all. And in fact, the irony is that, you know, we've never been more connected or hyper-connected than we are now, but the surveys tell us we've never been lonelier. So in the 1980s, for example, the General Social Survey discovered that we have an average of about three close contacts, including our family members, people we could lean on at times of stress or difficulty. Now that number is two or a little less. That includes your spouse, your children, your parents, your best friends. So many of us have like almost just one person. That means you all have, you're just one away from no one at all.
So for many people, almost nothing beyond their family, in fact, it sounds like, if it's only one or two or three.
Right, or besides your spouse.
Yeah. So you really make a distinction between the relationships we have online, which are many people's relationships today, right? Facebook and Twitter and just chatting all day long online. You consider there to be a sort of a quality difference in the conversations we have sitting across the table with someone and the kind we have on a computer.
Well, you know, there's an idea that has been batted about around a little bit since the research has been very serious about this domain called the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. So what this essentially means is that it all depends on who's using the technology. So people who have very rich social relationships, who have a very wide network, who get out into the community, they belong to clubs or they play cards or they volunteer or they go to church or however you get your social contact, those people will use their online networks to just get more of that. But then there's the other side of the coin of people who find it difficult or who are isolated. And essentially, those people are not getting the benefits from online connection that we all assume they are, in that it's displacing the contact that they would ordinarily have with people face-to-face.
Beyond feeling lonely or alone or isolated, which might be the result of what you're talking about, you also write about physical decline, sort of physical deterioration that can happen. Talk to us about some of the things that in your research you've found can happen if a person doesn't have enough face-to-face interaction.
Yeah, well, there's a whole cascade of kind of neurobiological events that occur when we communicate face-to-face. So we secrete oxytocin, which used to be thought of as they call it, the cuddle chemical. But essentially,
That's a great term.
Yeah, I mean, colloquially. But really, it's secreted. They used to think it was only happened with women. But it's secreted when of course, women give birth, when they nurse their babies, but also when we reach out to other people. And when we're in close contact with other people, it's partially what allows us to empathize with someone else. And it makes us feel good in the here and now. And it also has an impact on how our cells behave into the future. So that's one kind of cause.
Do we not get that release of oxytocin if we're having a great interaction on a screen with somebody?
No.
It has to be physical touch or physical
contact? Often there's eye-to-eye, you know, eye contact. There's the kind of patting and kind of echoing of body language that happens when you're face-to-face. You know, I'm looking at you now, and I can see the expression on your face, and this affects not only how I feel about what I'm saying, but what I'm going to say next. And that sometimes is missing. But let's get now to the health impact that you refer to. We have huge longitudinal studies which measure everything about a population here and now and then follow that population into the future. So they would measure, for example, their diet, their family lives, their smoking, their drinking, whether they get, you know, whether they were immunized, whether they live in a polluted place. And one very excellent study done at Brigham Young University had 309,000 subjects. It's a meta-analysis. They looked at all of these factors, and then they followed what happened to these people 7.5 years down the road. And they discovered that they could predict with fair degree of accuracy who would still be alive in 7.5 years based on the level of social contact that they had, meaning not just your intimates that I was referring to before, but how involved you were within your community. In other words, did you talk to your neighbors? Do you get out there and have diverse relationships? And what is really surprising, Sasha, is that it matters more than whether you smoke a pack a day. It matters more than whether you're lean or obese. It's more predictive than your alcohol consumption. So it's pretty much the most, of all the things that we can control in our lives, this is one of the things that's going to have the biggest impact on our health.
You cite many specific examples. I thought some of them were quite interesting. I mean, ranging from the value of a family meal, that research apparently claims that when it comes to jumpstarting a child's vocabulary, nothing beats sitting around and having a family meal, whatever sort of vocabulary software you may come up with. You have talked about studies that show that women with breast cancer with a large network of friends are more likely to survive than women with fewer social connections. Or lab rats with tumors, when those rats were isolated, they saw a big increase in number of tumors compared to rats that weren't isolated. I think that we get into that causation correlation question. Is it really clear from the research that isolation or loneliness leads to health declines? Could it be one of many other number of things in life?
Well, there's two parts to that question. So that, you know, you cannot deprive people of social contact as an experiment, but you can do that with rats. So we know that when we do that to female rats and we have them grow up by themselves instead of as a group, which is what they're used to, that the female rats develop 84 times the number of breast tumors. And we do know that, for example, in societies where there's a lot of social contact, which I describe in the book, and where there's a lot of social cohesion, there's a longer lifespan. Getting to that correlation causation question, we know as much about this topic as we do about cigarette smoking and cancer. Okay? That's also a correlational relationship. And it's strong enough, as is this one, for us to say, this should change our behavior. But you are right that it could be that the people who are healthier on all sorts of levels, meaning psychologically healthy, physically healthy, outgoing, etc., that will predict their longevity.
I'm talking with Susan Pinker. She's the author of the book, The Village Effect. It's about how face-to-face personal relationships not only have a positive effect on our health, but that a lack of them can be damaging to our health, to our physical well-being. And listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Susan, we have a number of callers. And let me go to Wesley calling from Wellesley. And Wesley, as you listen to this, what are your thoughts?
I'd just like to input that I've had a lot of great experiences with online interactions between people, being that they're not face-to-face, but that I'm still speaking to them or typing to them. And, I mean, I've made a lot of friends from across the country, across the globe. Got a couple of friends in Australia, some in England, California, Wisconsin, like all around. And they've just been there all the time. Whenever I log on, they're always saying, hey, what's going on? You doing all right? And they've helped me get through tough times as well, like, because I just have that security knowing that at the same time it's not my close friends that I'm seeing their faces react to whatever I'm telling them. But I don't know, I thought that not all the time, but sometimes there are cases where online interactions could be helpful to your health.
Well, Wesley, do you think there's a distinction? Like, do you differentiate in quality between your online relationships and your in-person, you know, friend-next-door relationships?
I do, because at the same time, there's none of that, like, rumors going around about those people. Like, what they tell you is what they tell you, and that's pretty much all you know. And it's, I don't know, it's kind of a hard question to answer.
Wesley, thanks for that. And Susan, before you weigh in, let me go to, we have so many callers. Let me just have a few come in, and then we can weigh in on all of them. And next we have Stephanie calling from Concord. Hi, Stephanie. What are your thoughts as you listen about this?
Hi, how are you?
Good, Howard. What do you think about this idea that too many online relationships, not enough face-to-face relationships, can actually hurt our health, our physical health?
Right. I wouldn't reject the validity of the distinctions or of the results of the studies, but I reject the either-or presentation of the argument. I mean, I'm middle-aged, so I'm not online 10 hours a day, and my husband and I both work full-time, and there's a huge health benefit in stress reduction to having those online networks. You know, a little bit of Facebook at 10 o'clock at night, I'm not going to be out with friends anyway at that hour. So I just don't think it has to be either or.
Stephanie, thanks for that. And let me bring in one more caller, Susan, before we have you weigh in. And this is Hannah calling from Brighton.
Hi.
Hi, Hannah.
How are you guys here?
Good. Tell us what you think about all this.
Well, I have a few notes. I actually have a very rich in-person social life, and I was raised in an Orthodox Jewish family, so I had a very solid background in socialization in large groups on a regular basis that involved a lot of singing, actually. And I find that not only does online and texting communication cut out the actual vibrations of the human voice, which I think we've all experienced, like the soothing effects of someone singing, or, you know, the kind of adrenaline kick that you get from an aggressive voice, like these are all like deeply kinesthetic feelings that are elicited through like vocal vibrations. And you miss out on those entirely, not to mention, what is it, like 80-something% of communication happens through body language. And there's a complete lack of that in online and texting communication. And I think both of those like lead to a very, like when you drop out all of the other sensory inputs that are involved in human communication and connection, and you like limit it to simply language, you're actually cutting out the things that make us need each other.
Hannah, that's really interesting. Susan Pinker, what do you think about all those thoughts the callers expressed?
Well, I'm going to go from back to front and respond to Hannah, and I think you're absolutely right, and that you do get something out of being together, especially with a group, that you just can't get from online interaction. However, the second caller, I will say, it is also true that it's not an either-or proposition, and that my view is that one should enhance the other, not necessarily replace the other. So my concern with the first caller, Wesley, is that when he said that, you know, all you know is what they tell you, that what's really important about online communication is that people can choose to tell you what they want, and sometimes it's actually not true. And some of the research that we're getting is that there's an awful lot of dissimulation or lying that goes on online because people present the persona that they want to be public, because online behavior is public behavior. But it doesn't mean that it's bad. It means that it's just a different type of communication. So I would compare it to, say, the difference between grabbing a quick sandwich at the McDonald's or your local fast eatery from the car window as you drive off to an appointment lest you be late, to sitting down with your family at Thanksgiving and having a dinner with recipes and chatter and friends and family all around. You're still getting calories. You may be getting the same number of calories. Both of them are going to sustain you, but it's not the same experience either aesthetically or emotionally, even though the calories are exactly the same.
Although, Susan Pinker, I'm thinking about even people here that I work with who can be sort of introverted, kind of minimally interactive when you're in person with them, the kind that sort of don't make eye contact in the hallway. But then these people are very alive on Twitter accounts. You see this active, expressive life. And certainly there are many people, I think, who thrive and blossom online in a way that makes them uncomfortable in face-to-face contact. So does your argument apply in every case, or are there some people whose physical health is better because they have an online outlet for communication?
Well, you know, let me address that introversion-extroversion question, which is that surprisingly, when the research is done on introverts, it shows that they need social contact just as much as everyone else. Introverts are about 20%, 25% of the population, and their health does not do well. This is work that's done by Sheldon Cohen in Pittsburgh. And they need to have social contact, but they need to be able to control it. So now I'm going to shift now to talking about what you were mentioning about Twitter. This is a highly controlled atmosphere, as you know, and so they say exactly what they need to say in a short little burst, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that as long as they have the other, because what we're learning from the studies is that people who have exclusively online interaction because they're more comfortable with that. So, for example, people on the autistic spectrum who make friends, okay, and I'm going to put some air quotes around those friends, online are very happy with those relationships in that they didn't have them before. But these friends do nothing to reduce their levels of loneliness. And similarly with, for example, online support groups. Online support groups are great for sharing information. They are not great for sharing human connection and that human bond that gives us that sort of emotional and social support that reduces our levels of stress or cortisol levels. So it's not really an either or. I think it's we have to learn how to balance our online contact with our face-to-face contact, just the way we would balance what we eat for a meal based on our particular appetite.
Susan, you have a term in your book that you call the middle layer. This is a reference to the people we just run into as we move through the day. I thought this was really interesting because part of the point you're making is we don't have to have best friend face-to-face interactions with everyone. You're saying there's even a loss when just those little interactions at the CVS checkout counter, at the grocery store, in the post office, even those quick, fleeting interactions are also what you're talking about here. That loss of those is a loss in some way.
Yes, and that's a really important distinction that you're making because, of course, we all need to have our close friends, the people that we love dearly and hold close to our hearts. But that middle layer, meaning the neighbors that you talk to, the person you see twice or three times a week at the store, people you might meet at school or at work, that layer is starting to diminish because of all our online interaction. And that is what is extremely predictive of some of the health outcomes I was talking about. And that's what they call diverse relationships. So, for example, if you're a member of a sports team or some civic project, you will be getting those automatically. But if you're not, you kind of have to find a way to work those in as we have less of a way to have those kind of casual, haphazard types of interactions throughout the day.
And we're running out of time, but I do want to note that you have suggestions, which are that basically people should build physical human contact into their workday. You know, save email for logistics. Basically, build your own village. And you say that a single bond, as you noticed before, like a spouse, really isn't enough to be sufficiently protective, which I thought was quite interesting. So, Susan, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
Susan Pinker is the author of the book, The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Happier, Healthier, and Smarter. Happier, Healthier, and Smarter. She'll be reading from and signing her book tonight at the Harvard Coop in Cambridge with her brother, Steven Pinker, the well-known Harvard cognitive scientist. You can find more information about Susan's event tonight on our website, radioboston.org. You can also find our interview with her brother, Steven, about his book, The Sense of Style, on our website. Stay with us. We have more of the show ahead. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.